Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We're going to read the Declaration to remind us of the purpose of our work here as a group. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty, as we will see in this summer's work, to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So the aim would be the realization of this brotherhood, which is today's topic, this unity. Our purpose is understanding. We are invited here to think on these lofty topics. And the teachings are just the writings of Theosophy in the original format given by the teachers back in the 1800s and early 1900s, late 1800s. So to accomplish those goals, we meet twice weekly in the summertime. Sunday mornings, 11 to noon, the doors open at 10:30, and we are in the study of individuality and personality. And this morning we're talking about I am-ness, being immortal, and next week will be the continuation of that topic. And on Wednesday evenings, doors open at 5:30, and there is a reference library open until 7:30, after which at 7:45, our Gita, Bhagavad Gita study class begins and goes until 9 p.m. There is always time for questions, discussion. The materials can be purchased at the book table just outside this room for the cost of shipping and printing, as we make no profit. And along those lines, we are sorely in need and much appreciative of any wish you might have to help along those lines, whether it's with the work, if you feel motivated to assist but don't know how, you can speak to the person at the book table. And of course, there's a donation box on your way out on the right side. A dollar given in the right way goes tremendously towards this effort. It keeps the lights on. It is spent right here to keep this lodge going. So the study this morning is a continuation of what we've been working on these summer Sundays. And it's called The Mystery of Individuality is I Am-ness Immortal. And as we said, this week is part one. Next week we'll continue the subject. And the way it will be presented is there'll be a summary given by a volunteer and then time for discussion and questions. Thank you.
So this topic is I am-ness, immortal, and this part is rather lofty. The summary we put together in large part is in the form of questions which incorporate the information in the part to introduce the ideas. Some of our great philosophical problems center around the question of immortality. What is our true origin? Will I ever stop being me? If we are immortal, then when the earth began, were we there observing it? Or were at least some of us there observing it if we were immortal, if we are immortal? As grand as these questions are, we are taught that there are no unsolvable mysteries. Therefore, although we may not know the answers to these questions or the solutions to these mysteries, our efforts in that direction will prove fruitful. Has the soul existed eternally in the past? And what about the eternal future? What about the individuality is or is not eternal? What composes the individuality? Are there limitations to the individuality? We are told that in our highest principles, we are individualized and separated only on the spheres of illusion by a differentiation which is as illusional, as elusive, we are individualized and separated only on the spheres of illusion by a differentiation as elusive as the rest. We perceive ourselves as personalities, distinct from other beings, who will prevail in the eternity as such. Yet, isn't the universe as we perceive it but a temporary part of the one beginningless and endless whole, that which ever was, is, and will be? And in this beginningless and endless whole, we're to seek for our uninterrupted immortality. In the eternal unity of that flame, is used as an analogy, in the eternal unity of that flame, of which we, as complex rays, act in our own straight line. What of our individual self-consciousness? Is self-consciousness also beginningless and endless? If self-consciousness is conditioned, then what is its condition within the unconditioned absolute during periods of universal rest? We are told the monad of every living being is an individual Dion Shohan, distinct from others, a kind of spiritual individuality of its own during one special great period of manifestation. Each ego has a body, which is immortal through the great period of manifestation, unless nirvana puts an end to it before. Well, when does this great period begin for us? At the beginning of such a period, what are the conditions of the beings present at the beginning of such a period? We're told that the beings in the first stage of such a period, or on the highest plane, are formless. They are bodiless. They are mere breaths. Subsequently, they descend to the second plane and but approach form. Then finally, on the third plane, they become that which incarnates in man. The first conditions are such that forces of nature are obligated to act under law according to impulse. Only at the stage of self-conscious man, who has both mind and consciousness, is there free will. Are these beings not conscious agents in the work? These higher beings who do not have free will, are they conscious agents in the work? They are conscious in as far as they act within the universal consciousness, but not until that stage reached, which makes them fit to incarnate, do they become self-conscious. It is only then that they become thinkers. Our topic for today is I am-ness immortal.
Thank you. It's a strange term for those of us who might be new to the philosophy, I am-ness. And just to give a brief idea of what that is, when we strip away everything that changes or is impermanent, our body, our feelings, our name, our hair, anything visible certainly can change. Anything that we possess and think is our own, our home or the possessions we have, when we strip all of that away and try to find that which is unchanging and everlasting, the philosophy says that the best way to describe that is I am. Regardless of circumstance, I am. I have always been. I will continue to be, and I will be in the future. There was never a time when I couldn't say, I am. I was a child. I am. I was a youth. I was older. I looked on all of those changes, but I was not affected by or still. That is the I am-ness, and that is a reflection of that unity beautifully described from which we came and to which we will return after this period of evolution has concluded. So we'll start with that idea. Any thoughts? Yes.
It's on the back of the sheet. I'm not quite sure which paragraph it is, but the paragraph starts with the secret doctrine definitely states.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the second sentence. Says, and in one of her articles, HPB suggests that each ego has a body, which is immortal throughout the human mantra, unless nirvana puts an end to it before. Two questions on that.
Mm-hmm.
When she says each ego has a body, now we're pretty certain we're not talking about the physical body, so we're kind of wondering what kind of body was being used, and if we could just discuss it, the last part where it says, unless nirvana puts an end.
Okay, so the questions are, what kind of a body is alluded to when it suggests that each ego has a body which is immortal throughout the Manvantara unless nirvana puts an end to it? Manvantara is that great period of evolution. Nirvana being that state of bliss, that highest possible state of conscious oneness, conscious unity after lifetimes of work. So the questions are, what is that kind of body and how does nirvana put an end to it? Well, it gives us, gratefully, some references. So from the reference, Theosophy 3, page 16, we hear this. It was a discussion on the different kinds of body and what their functions are. And the quote is, the third kind of body is the true ego, called in the East by a name meaning causal body, also called the karmic body in the Himalayan schools, which is the same. For karma or action is the cause which produces incessant rebirths or reincarnations. It is not the monad, nor is it manas proper, but it is in a way indissolubly connected with and a compound of the monad and manas in Devakan, which is that blissful state after death. So we're talking about the ego having a vehicle, as we understand it, the ego having a vehicle. The ego being that eternal perceiver, eternal thinker, that uses the form, the physical body, for action on this plane. That work taking place over, as was said, reincarnations, rebirths of eons of time, if the work is done, if duty is taken care of and the work is done with the right intention and motive, which would be our highest goal, eventually we will reach nirvana, at which point there is not a necessity for those vehicles anymore because all have blended back into the one. There is the choice, as we know, to come back and help and work with humanity, or there is the choice to go into nirvana. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, just Mr. Crosby speaks of it as a breath or a veil. So
the
when
body?
We think of a body, we
okay.
think of something
with form.
Material substance,
right.
And it isn't that. And we can see why it's necessary when we're taught that from Devakan, we return with the assimilation to some degree of the highest that we were able to use in that after-death state. So there has to be a form or a way to maintain
to
or
continue.
Retain that. And we can also see, if you go back to the analogy of the ocean, if each one of us is a drop of the ocean, if we return to that ocean, which is nirvana, we don't need the form of the droplet.
Right.
We're already completely one with it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the key note in that is returning to the one will happen psychically at the end of the period of evolution. But our goal is to have it happen consciously before that period. The whole point of taking up all of these vehicles and vestures and forms is to have the ability to work through the karma mentioned that we have created, therefore we must resolve, and in doing so bring us closer to the realization that I am, never changes, is eternal, is a reflection of that one spirit, and therefore we can eventually, our goal is to eventually blend heart and mind and work to the point where we consciously have the realization of that I am-ness and that unity. In the way in the back there?
We can use and we can think of this knowing this I am. We can think of just in our waking state, young children, teenagers, young folks, middle age, that I am never changes because it sees all the changes around it and through it. So it's not that far-fetched to understand that there isn't a part of our nature that is immortal.
Mm-hmm. And we think the easiest example of that is one with amnesia. They cannot remember their name. They don't know that they spoke French. They can't remember where they came from. They can say, I am. That is the only thing that comes through because the clouds have been washed away. When we are using the personality, the lower vehicles that are suitable for this plane of action, that I am-ness, in a sense, is set back, as was said, behind a veil, in a sense. And we're working in this muck and mire of the terrestrial world. Once all of that has been, the amnesiac is the perfect example, once all of that has been pushed aside, I am is what is realized. We need to do that consciously, but in that case, the one has nothing but that, knows I am and is okay with that. And your hand was up.
Yeah. Well, could we begin with the idea of force, energy, the ability to do work, and the that it is dynamic, but at what point does can we conceive of that force, that energy, that ability to do work?
How do, maybe we could restate, how do we recognize it? How does it become understandable to us? It is a dynamic, magnetic, electric, spiritual reflection of that which is itself, electricity, magnetism, spirit, all. So being a spark of that, or a ray, let's say, of that spiritual sun, we are not less than that, we are a portion of it. So we can never be less than it in reality. And we think we feel it best or most easily in these lifetimes when we put aside our selfish pursuits and help another. And often it takes a crisis or some serious situation where we are called upon or feel that impulse which comes from the higher, I can be of service here. And we put everything else aside. In that moment, we are living consciously that I amness. We are recognizing that we are all this spiritual unity, and there is one in need, and we put aside our personal selfish needs and help another. We honor that and get closer to that. Follow up?
It says here, the Ahi are forces, not human beings. It seems that what the chair just mentioned applies to that particular area of the spirit. But are they not conscious beings? And I think the last paragraph, the book is grasped, or following the chain from within.
From within, without, are the Ahi, or the forces, not conscious agents in the work. Conscious in as far as they act within universal consciousness. So the Ahi, we had some reference on. It's interesting because in the glossary, the Ahi are defined as serpents, Dion Chohan's wise serpents, dragons of wisdom. So the force, as it were, contains all of that which we need to move forward. And in the very beginning of the description of evolution in the secret doctrine, the third line, the first couple of lines, the eternal parent wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, had slumbered once again for seven eternities. This is Pralaya. The work has been done. There is the recollection, the reunion, and then there is rest. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration. There wasn't a need for that differentiation. The third statement is, universal mind was not, for there were no Ahi to contain it. So, and then it goes on from there as a description of coming forth and evolution. So the Ahi at once being the force and the helpers. We don't know how better to say that. In the back?
Well,
We think the complication for all of us is there's only one reality. And since everything comes from that one reality, as it says in the paragraph above, lastly, the Ahi are the incarnating egos. For as said, they are the collective hosts of spiritual beings. We are that, but while we are in incarnation, we couldn't be further removed from that, except through meditation or the moments you spoke of, or selflessness. We were thinking earlier about the I am-ness in unity. If you've ever performed in a chorus, or performed in an orchestra, or a band, anything where your part was just part of it, but you had to do your own individual part, and so did everybody else. But what comes out of it is not your part or my part,
it's
but a collective piece of something intelligent. Well, we think that's like the same thing. We have to realize we are a player in that band or that orchestra, and hopefully we start following the script or the score instead of our own personal desires. But we have to realize in our essence, we are that Ahi, and we should turn upwards towards it.
And
the description is apt because the other thing that happens before a performance, whether it's on stage or in an orchestra, conduction of an orchestra, there is a moment where everyone is called together. Stage workers are called together and reminded of the task and then separate. In the orchestra, before the piece, the conductor will tap, get everyone's attention. Everyone plays a single note and then is set to, as was described, play their individual part, which at the end will finish the entire whole. So it's a very good description for that, yes.
So in that sentence that was just referred to the last contributor, the Ahi of this Manvantara exist no longer. They have long ago become planetary, solar, lunar, and lastly incarnating egos. For as said, they are the collective hosts of spiritual beings. So one thing that's helpful about that is when the word host is used in philosophical or religious works, the host is that idea is associated with creation or with formation or with the new outbreath of manifestation. And a useful analogy for that word host would be if we think of the rainforest in South America, there are strains of plants, flowers and things that can't grow on the ground. They have to grow only on a specific tree, but they're not from the tree. Their seeds get laid there by the wind or by other birds or whatever, and they literally grow out of the tree. So the tree is the host. And literally, that's what it's referred to as, in symbiotic biological relation, or even in a parasitic biological relation. A tick will lay eggs in a dog, the dog is the host. And the fact is, those ticks that, they become ticks, but they become ticks by using the energies and by using the dog's blood for food. So essentially, they evolved to be ticks from the matter used by the host. Similarly, this is saying they are the collective hosts of spiritual beings. We are the spiritual beings. If we accept that we are the spiritual beings, the source of our of everything that constitutes us as a spiritual being is that host, is the archangels, as it were, the Anshohans.
Right.
So in that sense, they are our source, they are who, what we are in our highest essence.
And in the evolutionary scheme, the host or vehicle or container of each level of the highest spiritual essence drops a speck further down until we come to the point where we reach man arriving on the scene, the form is ready, the vehicle or host is ready, that which contains...
No, man is not the host.
Sorry. The host, right, I understand. The vehicle, being the form for man, contains the host carrying or infused with or part of or one with that spiritual essence. Is that in line with what you were saying?
Yeah, we're trying to get it.
English. Yes.
Well, it just came to our mind. What does ness mean? Hyphen ness. And couldn't we say like unto?
Well,
but
we...
Not like unto. What does ness mean?
Ness gives it, I am-ness or be-ness, gives it complete anonymity. There isn't an attribute. There isn't a descriptor. It keeps it, when we say be-ness or I am-ness, it is to remind us that it is not separated or differentiated in any way, shape, or form in its essence. So the ness keeps it neutral, in a sense. Any other ideas?
In that paragraph right at the bottom of page 2, a man can choose what he will think about. Man has free will, and the ahi have none. If one is a student of the Bible, there is the explanation for the why in Genesis that the Elohim were protesting the freedom that man was going to be given because he would be greater than the gods, because he could choose, whereas the gods have no choice but to act within the framework of their own hierarchy, which it's very strange if you stop and think about it, that a human being has a greater potential than the greatest god you can imagine. It's hard for us to believe because we're so busy interacting in the opposite way without realizing our powers. But we are greater than any god because of that free will and choice.
The ability to choose is what allows us to surpass the work of any that came before. As is the case with every one of our brothers, sisters, agents along the way when they reach the stage of human or man. It says mind is lit up by those who bring that spiritual light forward, those hosts. Mind becomes active so that as man we become self-conscious. We can look at ourselves, we can choose, we can direct our thinking. And if thoughts are things and we are continually creating, we have the capacity, the ability to choose the better at any given moment. It's just a matter of saying, I will. The creative will is that power, that eternal gift in a way, and how we use it not only creates our future, but when we use it improperly, we're telling the universe we don't want it, we don't need it, we're busy with this ugly personal thing over here, this habit or tendency, when we should be getting busy looking forward or looking up, as was said earlier. And it is said when we're working in the right direction, with heart and mind attuned to the best motive possible, we lift that veil a little bit at a time, and that spiritual I am-ness is able to shine forth. We know because we've done it at certain times in our lives. We know we are the best we can be at that moment. And there is a shining about that. People notice that. People wonder what it was you did. And we don't even know sometimes, but the more we practice, in that direction, the more natural that tendency will become. Did you have an idea?
Yes. There's a saying in common usage that all that we see is but a dream in our mind of God. With that in mind, I'd like to ask, what then can we learn from the avatars, who are those who have completely immersed their consciousness or been immersed in the consciousness, in the God consciousness? What of them? What of their individuality? What of their personality? What can we learn from them by observing them?
They are us. We are them, less progressed. Everything is equal on the plane of spirit. It is simply a differentiation of work done and lessons perceived and realized. So what those who are more elevated teach us is that it's possible. The greatest dream that we can have of God or beingness or deity is that idea of conscious oneness and the ability to be of service to those still climbing the ladder. So the greatest gift they offer us is hope. And if this is true, if perfection or perfectibility is possible, and we prove it every day, we've been through school, we've been through jobs, we've learned new crafts, and each time we perfected something and moved forward to the next level of perfectibility. So we've proved it's possible. The highest point of that is possible for us. It is the greatest source of hope we can imagine. Yes.
Question. Why the avatars and how can we reach them? Well, we'll make a little phrase. I'm out of my mind most of the time in this world.
I'm out of my mind most of the time in this world.
And yet we read in the teaching, raise yourself by yourself. So it seems it requires an effort on our part to even come within
to think. Exactly. That's what this entire series of articles is for, to make us think, to challenge us. To the phrase is to challenge us out of our sempiternity, to wake us up to these possibilities. Yes.
Well, we're thinking we have, and we didn't in other ages. We had to rely on our own memory or finding someone wiser than ourselves. We have the Sermon on the Mount. We have the Bhagavad Gita. We have the Dhammapada. We have the Tao Te King. Whatever resonates within you as spiritual food, you should turn to it. If every day you pick up those ideas, deal with the expressions of that avatar, you are close to them at that moment. And it has to affect you for your good health, mentally and physically.
Yes, we draw near to those who have perfected themselves in prior periods by just what was mentioned, reading the materials, thinking on them, meditating on them, trying to imagine what it would be like to act and react on that kind of a level of thinking. And knowing that it is possible because perfectibility is possible. So an avatar, an adept, a master, whatever level they have arisen to, have left the wonderful writings mentioned and everything in theosophy for us as breadcrumbs, guideposts, markers along the path that we are journeying on. Pick this up, take this idea with you at the end of the day before you go to sleep. Pick up one of the little spiritual writings. It might even be a phrase or two, a paragraph. Take that with you into sleep. Wake up with that. We had a hand here and then here.
Yes. One of the things that you see prevalent among avatars, and it's something that we spoke of a couple of weeks ago among bees and ants, is that the individual form has abandoned its attachment to that form and has attached its consciousness to something higher. It is not moving according to the form, it's moving according to something above the form. That's one of the things that I think is really important, because it is not the personality that has become truly, it has abandoned the personality, it has moved above that.
Oh, did you say abandoned its attachment to the form? We thought you said banded. I'm sorry.
Right.
Okay.
No, it abandons that form.
Abandons the attachment to the
to
form,
that, to
exactly.
That.
Even if in the form,
right.
Along the way. But if the consciousness and the effort is on the higher, that's the right path.
In fact, in Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus is talking in Sermon on the Mount, the things that he says, he's not concerned about clothing, not concerned about food. He has no idea, he has no desire whatsoever to make progress in this society or anything like that. In fact, he says, look at the lilies of the field. Who dresses better than them? That's not a man who's going out looking for suits on civil row. This is a man who has completely abandoned all of that. This is what we learn, is that mindset, as you move up, that mindset becomes part of the greater. And that seems to be the answer to what we're speaking on today. What happens to the individual? It moves up as it moves up, it drops more and more.
The only thing we would perhaps say about what was said was, we are never separate from the higher mind, the higher consciousness, the eternal. Yes.
You're absolutely right. But that's why this is a dream in the mind of that.
Right. And the self-conscious awakening of that fact is what these steps are on that path. Yes. I'm sorry, we heard the term.
We are eternally distinct. And when we reach a point and find out, choose between what we think we are, selfish personality, me, alone, then that's where the battle seems to begin, because there are he who seeks a reward for his actions has the wrong idea. He who thinks he knows has the wrong idea. So it seems that there is, we have to get over ourselves, so to speak.
Exactly, because our question was going to be, who are we deceived by? Ourselves. The ideas that we hold that are false are our self-deceptions. And they will last and direct our action just as long as we give them power and truth and belief. The moment we are able to step aside from them and consider something different and test it and work with it and check the results against the old way of thinking, that's when we are actively putting all this into motion. And the Theosophy tells us no effort is wasted. From lifetime to lifetime, as the cycle turns, like day and night, the seasons of the year, birth, death, and rebirth, we carry with us all of the work done and begin, hopefully, to work better and higher each time. Yes.
The speaker spoke of how we look at ourselves, does remind us that one of the more serious things we do is look critically at others,
mm-hmm.
and how unhealthy that is for us. We wish we had written it down. We just read a beautiful quote that sometimes we see sort of a stain on someone else's personality, and we think, oh, that's just awful. And the individual wrote, if we really could see, we might realize that is a scar from a battle that they fought that we would have run away from.
Mm.
So when we see something to criticize in another, we should stop and say, you know, that might be something, some battle they're close to winning. What battle should I be doing?
So it's offering the better thought for the other. We see people acting out. Maybe we're on a bus and we see someone acting out. They might have just come from chemotherapy. We don't know. And if we attribute the highest to the other and separate the soul from the action, that is I am that. And there is no distinction between us except the illusion that was mentioned. The outer form, the way our hair looks, the place we came from, the color of our skin, they're all temporary. They even change within our own lifetime. So it's, we completely lost our train of thought. There, please.
The other danger from that is that we poison ourselves with the idea of our superiority.
Oh,
I'm better
than
this
judgment,
person,
thank you.
Because I
yeah.
would do such and such. And that is a poison that sluts our worth.
Absolutely, and judgment is something before we apply it to another, we should stop and turn it on ourselves. Because we're all reflections and mirrors for one another. If it's something that agitates us in what another is doing, it's probably something we have to work on in ourselves. If it doesn't agitate us, we've probably been through that and understand it and have conquered it. But we're all at different steps and different moments on the journey and can offer service of what we have learned when it's asked for, and can assist others who are in need, or at the very least turn a kind eye on one another and realize we're all struggling in different ways. Yes.
The first step is to realize that we're making judgments, because often we're convinced by education or training or otherwise that our position is the only correct one, and then that blinds us. So first we have to become open to the fact that we're making judgments, and that's difficult. And the only way usually is through some kind of serious setback in life.
Suffering, absolutely.
And suffering, whether it be physical or mental or even addiction, maybe someone suffered from addiction for many years, finally kicked it, and then they're able to see clearly. But often those that are the most successful in life are the ones that they think, well, I did everything right, so therefore I'm able to judge. And then we do have judges, of course, that need to make judgments, and hopefully we get a good judge if we're in trouble, a fair one.
Well, that's a point to be made, because whether or not the judgment seems fair to us, in quotes, what will happen in the long run? Yes.
You can't avoid getting what's yours.
You can't avoid what is going to come back to you. If we set it into motion, it's got our thumbprint on it. When it returns and may look ugly or may look terribly difficult, that thumbprint is still on it, so the justice will be merited, although we may not be able to see it in the moment, yes.
Well, that's the great thing about studying these principles, is that when things happen that seem that they seem unfair, or if we were completely innocent of a crime and we go before a judge and receive a harsh sentence,
we might have accused another.
Sometimes we deserve it. because it came to us. So then we need
yeah.
to deal with it and to rise above, because we are the observer. We're so much more than our body, our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings, our interactions, our relations with others. We are that eternal, the I am-ness, the observer. And that's when we're really called to task.
From one of the magazine Theosophy articles, we just have to repeat our favorite thought along those ideas. We are divine fragments of the all-pervading deity, entombed in the flesh, and working out through slow and painful progress towards our reunification with the all. It's a wonderful article, and we can get you the reference if you'd like it.
Musings on the True
Theosophy
app.
Thank you.
We wanted to say there was a technique years ago that we think really helps to see someone else in a different light. We don't remember what it was called, psychodrama or something. If you're in the middle of an argument with someone, let's say a parent and a child, you
mm-hmm.
reverse roles.
Yeah.
So the child acts as the parent as the child, and it makes you see the thing from the other's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're failing. As was said, we're standing in judgment, and that's a judgment from our point of view. So when we switch the point of view, we see how the other is feeling, which is
yes.
more important even than how they're thinking. So if we could do that once in a while, pretend to be the other,
yes.
and see why they feel and act as they do, we'll be much more charitable.
And if we aren't able to do that, to put ourselves in that position, then we know we are fully attached to whatever that feeling or judgment was, and that's where our work has to begin. Yes.
On the quote that you just said, it's a beautiful quote, and this is in no way to criticize you or the quote, but the language itself,
yes.
when you say you are a fragment,
mm-hmm.
how is it possible to be a fragment of the indivisible whole?
Okay. Theosophy describes it as, in different ways, it says we are a ray, we are a reflection. We are a divine fragment. We've read that in other places. It is to describe that this universal, unconditioned, not even universal, it's beyond that, unconditioned, omnipresent, immutable spiritual essence, this oneness, this divinity.
Indivisible.
Indivisible, thank you. Well, that's what we're studying this summer. This deific essence is the source of all. We are rays or fragments or divine reflections. We all are that in the differentiation process of evolution. We are differentiated only as long as evolution takes, until we are reabsorbed into the whole. So when we say we are fragments, we are in essence that, but differentiated for the moment, manifested for the moment eternally that it takes for our learning and our evolution to take place. We will be reabsorbed, the great in-breathing, that period of rest will take place, and then cycles will roll forward. Yes.
Water is such a great example. You take the ocean, it is one thing, and all parts of it are identical, but throw it out on the sand and you get individual droplets. But what happens to water anywhere? It becomes part of a cycle of return
mm-hmm.
to that very ocean.
Right.
There
goes
is no end of that circulation, whether it's within us or within the solar system. So the integrity of the whole is always there, but the individualized fragments are always in process somewhere. So we think it's complicated.
It is. And a wonderful experience to help us understand that very idea is to look at or study fractals. They are tiny pieces of a whole picture that when you look at the tiny piece, it is the whole picture. And the only thing we can describe it as an acorn, when it's cut open, has, is it the whole tree?
No, that's the lotus. The acorn has the oak tree, but it isn't
the acorn has the oak tree.
The lotus has a picture of a future plant.
Okay, that's what it is. But look up fractals, and it is that. It is the one, but differentiated, but still the one. And it's impossible to describe that. Yes? Judge the action, not the actor, and judge not, lest ye be judged. Wonderful thoughts to keep in mind. Yes?
You know, when people say the Lord's Prayer, we think they don't realize what they are asking of the highest. It is a statement that says, let me be judged as I judge others. And if that were really to happen to us, we'd be absolutely appalled because we're very critical of others. But we have to realize that that's what we're asking life to do to us.
Yes.
Treat me exactly as I treat others. The golden rule isn't something we have to do. That's where we fall down. It's something that is done, whether we like it or not.
But the golden rule can also be a motivator for us.
Well,
knowing that balance will take place, that equality, that harmony will be restored, what can be our motive moving forward? Let me act towards another as I would want towards me, or let me not harm another as I would not want to be harmed. So it's a statement of a rule of law, but it can also be our motivator. Pick any of these thoughts as a motivator and start your day out with them.
But
yes.
The problem is that people think it can be a motivator. You can put it up on your wall and use it when you want to. If they knew, I'm sorry, this is the
truth.
Law. This is the way life works. As you do, it will be done.
Mm-hmm.
If they knew that, they would stop acting the way they all of us would, if we really knew it.
Absolutely. Yes.
We were just going to ask that irrespective of all we read and hear and so forth, it's incumbent upon each individual to find his own peace within himself.
Yes.
Irrespective of the world around him, that peace that we all seek has to come from within. Not judging other people, but we cannot help but observe, but find your peace within. And I think finding peace within has something to do with a true realization of the self.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're reminded that the path is one, but varies with the pilgrim. So we can never judge what one another has chosen as their path. So we'll just finish up with the bottom of page one. The whole visible and invisible universe are only a temporary part of the one beginningless and endless whole, or that which ever was, is, and will be. Meeting adjourned.